This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to
the Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
It's January 30th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. For those of you joining us for the first time, humanism is a worldview based on reason, compassion, and creativity.
Oh, Duncan.
Oh, Jess. Do you ever feel like we're on You Can't Do That on television? Remember that show?
Where they would pop out of the lockers?
Yeah, they pop out of the lockers. Oh, so-and-so, yeah. All right, what's going on? What?
Do you know what significant date is quickly approaching us?
Other than Valentine's Day and Abraham Lincoln's birthday? Yes. February 12th is known around the world as Darwin Day. It's an international celebration of science and humanity on the anniversary of the birthday of Charles Darwin. How did I do? Was that good?
That was good. And this year happens to be the 199th anniversary.
That's right. Of Charles Darwin. Yeah. And then it's also the 149th anniversary of The Origin of Species.
Yep.
Which is Darwin's book where he first presented the scientific theory of natural selection and talked about how creatures evolve on this planet Earth.
That's right. Now, this is a worldwide celebration,
mm-hmm.
But in the U.S.
Wherever our listeners are joining us, you know, the theory of evolution might not be so controversial in your neck of the woods, but according to some recent Gallup polls, something like 43% of the U.S., 43% of Americans do not believe in the theory of evolution, which is why the proponents of this holiday of sorts feel that it's important for people to learn about Darwin.
So what are some things that people do on Darwin Day?
Well, some people host events where they have debates or lectures, or some people like to have a screening of Inherit the Wind, which is the film about the Scopes monkey trial, where evolution was put on trial, essentially. I like to dress up as an ape.
Not much different than any other day, I gotta say.
Yeah, that was just a general statement. And, you know, you can have an evolution banquet, or you can eat primordial soup, or serve up Darwin fish fries if you want.
The Institute for Humanist Studies recently took over the Darwin Day Celebration Project. You can get more information at darwinday.org.
And in preparation for Darwin Day, we're going to be bringing you a special Darwin-themed program.
Our first guest is the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. And then we're going to hear from singer and anthropologist Richard Milner, creator of Charles Darwin Live and in Concert. And if we can get our finches in a row... We'll have a special guest, a really special guest for you folks. So Duncan, tell us about our first guest.
Matthew Chapman is the great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin. He grew up in England and moved to the U.S. in the 1980s. He is a writer, director, and producer. He's written several articles and two books about Charles Darwin. The first is Trials of the Monkey, an Accidental Memoir. And the second is 40 Days and 40 Nights, Darwin, Intelligent Design, God, OxyContin, and Other Oddities on Trial in Pennsylvania. I recorded this telephone interview on Saturday. Matthew Chapman, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me today.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Now, you have both a personal and a professional relationship to Charles Darwin. I want to start with the personal. How long have you known that you're a descendant of Charles Darwin?
Oh, from very early on, from, I would think, about the age of four. Mm-hmm. We lived in Cambridge, England, in fairly academic circles, and it was a matter of kind of pride to be connected to Darwin, but it wasn't in any way controversial or particularly, it wasn't that interesting. Mm-hmm. It was just a sort of a connection to a historical figure whose work had been done and everybody had really moved on.
Mm-hmm. Now, although you have said that you've been an atheist or an agnostic for some 30 years or so, you've also confessed to having been a young zealot, a young religious zealot in your youth, and you read the Bible, you were raised in the Church of England, you prayed. So I'd like to ask you, while you were still a religious child, did you have any conflict regarding your great-grandfather, great-great-grandfather's theory of evolution?
None whatsoever. In fact, if I had to say what my image of God was as a child, it would have been a combination of Darwin and Leonardo da Vinci. they were both bald, had big gray beards, and kind of looked wise. And kind. I mean, I think they were both very kind men. And when you refer to me as a zealot, I wasn't exactly a zealot. I just wanted to be a saint. That's all. That was my ambition, was to be a saint and do good things. And you know, God and I would go out there and make the world better and happier and more peaceful.
Yeah. Now, have you inherited any family lore about Charles Darwin? Are there any stories about him passed down through the generations? Perhaps maybe these stories have evolved over time that most of us folks wouldn't have heard about Charles Darwin?
Well, there are two things. I mean, I think both of which actually people who know about Darwin would have heard about. One is a suggestion of hypochondria and depression, which are thought, I mean, certainly the depressive aspects of his character are thought to sort of descend down the female line of the Darwin family. And certainly my grandmother and my mother were both very prone to depression. Mm. And then, of course, the hypochondria is always a slight mystery because people don't really know whether it was some disease he picked up on his trip on the Beagle,
yeah,
or whether in fact it was, some people suggest that it was a sort of an existential guilt that was manifest through his body. I have no idea. I have a little tendency to hypochondria myself. Nobody likes to get sick, you know.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that is, I think is also known about him, but that I think is very fascinating and relevant to modern times, is that he used to keep a notebook. I think it was a notebook. He used to keep notes on any scrap of information that he found that contradicted his theories, because he said that it was very easy to discard things that were not in line with what you wanted to believe. And so it was important to write down everything so you didn't forget it and didn't discount it. And I think that that kind of intellectual honesty is something that has gone absent in a lot of public life in America.
Mm. Yeah. I would think that some of my ex-girlfriends would agree with that human nature, human tendency to discard things that don't fall in line with what I believe or remember.
that's your own personal business. I'm talking about matters of state.
You moved from England to the U.S. in about the 1980s. Is that correct?
Yes.
And you came to this country to work in as a screenwriter in Hollywood.
Screenwriter and director, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And I know one of the things you've remarked on is how superstitious and, you know, spiritual Hollywood is. You were surprised to encounter that?
I was astonished. I mean, yeah, really astonished. Because, you know, I was born in 1950, so I went through the 60s and early 70s and the hippies and, you know, the age of Aquarius and all of that nonsense. But by the time, by the 1980s in Great Britain, and I think in most of Europe, the whole idea of astrology had really sort of fallen on hard times. And when I came to America and I heard people asking, you know, what's your sign? I thought they were joking. I thought that that kind of thing had, I thought of it as being a sort of a quaint feature of the 60s. And I really thought that way of thinking was over. And I was shocked. And then, of course, I was shocked to hear that you know, creationism was still taken seriously.
Mm-hmm. And was that a motivating factor for you to, in 2000, you traveled down to Dayton, Tennessee, which is the town where the famous Scopes monkey trial occurred. Was that part of your motivation?
Very much a motivating factor. I mean, really, I didn't think about Darwin at all in England and never mentioned my connection to him. And I was really shocked that creationism was being taken seriously in a country as sophisticated as America. And my idea of what America was like was really gleaned from The New Yorker, which my parents took. Comedians like Shelley Berman and Woody Allen. And so my idea of America was very sophisticated, a very sophisticated country. And, of course, technologically fantastic, you know, went to the moon and all that stuff. So to find this pocket of superstition, but rabid superstition,
yeah,
I really wasn't prepared for it, and I'm still not.
Now, what did you discover? The purpose of this project, your book, Trials of the Monkey, which you call an accidental memoir, you traveled to Dayton, Tennessee, to observe the town's ritual of recreating the Scopes monkey trial annually.
They do what they call a recreation or a reenactment. They call it of the Scopes monkey trial. But because the area has not really changed in the last 80 years, they still retain the same prejudices and foibles. And so the play is, or at least it was when I finally got to see it, it has all of the good bits edited out. Mencken doesn't put in an appearance at all. As I remember when I saw it, the whole encounter where Clarence Darrow humiliates William Jennings Bryan by putting him on the stand as an expert witness on the Bible, where he asks him all these questions about, was Jonah really swallowed by a whale and all of that stuff. All of that was cut out, and it was portrayed as a complete victory for fundamentalism, which, of course, in a sort of narrow legal sense, it was a victory because Scopes was found guilty. But it really wasn't seen that way by the nation or the world. It was seen as an embarrassment.
Now, Matthew, this was the first trial that was broadcast live to the world. Is that correct?
Yes, it was broad. I mean, this is, to me, the most fantastic detail. It was, and particularly having covered a second trial, the Kitzmiller v. Dover trial. But in 1925, it was clearly thought that this was a scandal that this trial was taking place, and that it was fascinating, and that it was a spectacle, and indeed it was. And it was broadcast live to America, to Europe, bits of Europe, and to Australia. Mm. So people were tuning in to this debate about the nature of our existence with real enthusiasm and interest. When I got to cover Kitzmiller v. Dover, which was the recent intelligent design versus evolution trial in Pennsylvania, it was a pretty hot topic for a few weeks, but nothing compared to the Scopes trial in terms of the attention that it got.
Well, I want to talk about your work covering the Dover trial in 1 minute, but I have heard that you really you came to fall in love with the town, Dayton, Tennessee, and the people.
Absolutely. I liked it a great deal. I liked people with whom I have had the greatest disagreement philosophically became good friends. I still talk to some of them. And, of course, I mean, I have a lot of friends who believe in God in all kinds of ways, from the quite primitive to the very sophisticated. And, in fact, one of the people I most admire in life is a theologian called John Hort, a Catholic, who I think has a fantastic way of looking at God and religion, and is a really great human being. I'm married to a Catholic, but a Brazilian Catholic, and that's where you get into the primitive end of things.
Well, I understand that you went spelunking with a fundamentalist biology professor in this town. Can you tell me about that?
Oh, that was unbelievable. Yeah, it was a trip to a cave up in a mountain in Tennessee. And the purpose of this horrific trip to the bowels of the earth was to look at various kind of brachiopods and shrimp-like fossils that under a sort of under an evolutionary view would be seen as showing how the earth has changed topographically over millions of years, but which under the creationist version, what it shows is that there was a huge flood that washed all these shrimps and stuff up into this cave a few thousand years ago. Mm. And then the waters receded and kind of pulled out bits of the cave with it. And that's how that was the purpose of the trip, which was really frightening because, you know, you're in a cave with 30 young Christians all sort of banged on the walls and singing hymns. It was scary but kind of delightful.
How were the students eating this up, or did you spot a few skeptics in the student crowd? Or,
well, I thought I did, but I was mistaken. Uh-huh. But I did become very friendly with two of the young Christians from William Jennings Bryan College, which is up on the hill outside Dayton. And I still correspond with them, and they're very interesting. I mean, you know, whatever failings Christianity has in America, it's a pretty good organization for young people if you're hooked into it. I mean, you get sent to interesting countries, you have access to interesting jobs. I mean, the two that I'm talking about went to work in Egypt and had really interesting lives and were fun, nice people. I mean, really interesting people. And, you know, I think it's a failure of the secular world and of government that things like the Peace Corps don't seem to be able to offer the same sense of community and adventure and service that that I definitely saw down in Tennessee.
Darwin, grandson of a poet, also of a potter, was brought up by his sister.
Hi, this is Maureen Matsumura, and you're listening to Humanist Network News. Come read our e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. It's got my Sweet Reason Advice column, Dale McGowan's Parenting Beyond Belief column, and the latest news that every freethinker needs to know.
We're listening to an interview with Duncan and Matthew Chapman, great-great-grandson of Charles Darwin.
Where he earned a degree. Insects intrigued him more than preaching, and so he joined the Beagle and found a perfect niche there as a naturalist.
Now, Matthew Chapman, the Scopes trial is history, but historical, but you actually had an opportunity to observe a real life court case where they put evolution on trial in Dover, Pennsylvania. You traveled down to cover this trial for Harper's Magazine, and it involved a school board which was requiring the teaching of intelligent design in the classroom. Was the atmosphere of that trial similar to the Scopes trial, or I think you said earlier it wasn't quite as theatrical?
It wasn't quite as theatrical. I mean, you couldn't top William Jennings Bryan coming into town with a loudspeaker car trying to sell real estate during the week while preaching on Sundays. You couldn't find a character like Mencken who was calling them yokels and theological thugs and all the other kind of fantastic language that he came up to describe the trial, not altogether accurately at times. But it was pretty intense, the Kitzmiller v. Dover. I mean, it was intense and it was fascinating because it was not a jury trial, but then in a sense the Scopes trial, although it was a jury trial, the jury was excluded from the courtroom an enormous amount of the time. So you had this, but you did have the tension in court of having a Republican judge who was going to decide this case, who was appointed by George W. Bush. You had something that was lacking from the Scopes trial. All the scientific evidence was excluded from the Scopes trial, basically all of it. In this case, the trial was really decided on the merits of science. So you had the plaintiff, the parents who were suing the school board to have intelligent design removed from the classroom, putting on a case for evolution and a case against intelligent design. You had then the intelligent design advocates defending themselves and trying to make a case for intelligent design. So you had a trial that was, you know, on the one hand, it was a philosophical trial, but on the other hand, it was a heavily scientific trial. And what was fascinating about it to me, and what has actually led me on to what I'm doing now, is that it meant that both sides had to put on complicated scientific testimony in a way that was comprehensible to a judge who had no science background. And you then had in the jury box the press, and in the courtroom you had the community. And what you saw as both sides put on their case was that it was possible to discuss complicated scientific matters in a way that was comprehensible and fascinating, given the context, to ordinary people. And what it made me realize was that I now believe that science has an obligation, if it's to survive and be effective, to constantly be making its case in the court of public opinion, and that it's possible to do so. Obviously, it's not possible to explain all of physics, but you can explain basic ideas in a way that makes it exciting.
Well, I understand that you said the scientists in the courtroom were much more animated than the proponents of intelligent design, much more interesting to listen to. Is that right? Much happier, too, I think.
Yes. I mean, there was a tremendous enthusiasm that you felt from people who were devoting their lives to discovering what was true in nature and what was not true in nature. And what you also saw among the scientists on the side of evolution, which I would say would be on the side of science, was a great respect and delight in mystery. The fact that one has not discovered everything about nature, far from being something that was depressing or needed to be solved immediately, was a great challenge, an adventure. On the side of intelligent design was a completely different attitude, which was that if you didn't understand something in nature, you had to fill that gap with a theological explanation, that there was something kind of intolerable about unexplained matters. And I think that is the difference between the worst aspects of religion and the best aspects of science. I think you would have people like John Hort, for example, who was on the side of the plaintiffs, the Catholic theologian, who would say that there is something beautiful about mystery, whether it's scientific mystery or philosophical mystery, that in that mystery is what makes life worth living.
Yeah. I heard you describe these intelligent design proponents in the court case as being sullen, defensive, unhappy, and also exhibiting almost the signs of a pathological addiction to unreason and superstition. Can you expound on that?
Well, I mean, I have to say, first of all, that the main exponent of intelligent design, Michael Behe, is a very nice guy, and I like him, and he can be very funny at times. But if you watch the trial unfold, and you saw the enormous weight of evidence for evolution, I mean, most of which has been discovered since Darwin died, since The Origin of Species was published, and all of the sort of exploration of the genome and decoding of DNA and all of these understandings we have about bacteria that we didn't have when Darwin was alive, the way in which things evolve on a very minuscule level. The weight of that evidence is really overwhelming and kind of, on the one hand, very obvious. I mean, obviously, what is strong survives and passes on its genes to its offspring, which therefore becomes sort of more complicated and improved, if you want to use that phrase. But also this sort of the molecular level at which it's being proved, the way in which diseases evolve, it's just overwhelming. And so when you then saw intelligent design put on its case, you kind of thought, why are you guys doing this? I mean, you're on it's so quixotic, it's so pointless. What are your motives for doing this? I mean, clearly the motive, to me it appeared, were to defend a literal interpretation of the Bible, which is kind of unnecessary. I mean, there are all kinds of believers who have found ways to incorporate the idea of evolution into another idea of God that, you know, set the first spark or, you know, whatever sophisticated ways in which you want to look at God. There are ways to incorporate evolution into that. So to be fighting this battle that was sort of lost, really, 100 years ago, it just seems it seemed obsessive and compulsive and sad, neurotic.
I thought that, you know, intelligent design had lost its momentum after this trial, but I understand there's a new movie coming out by Ben Stein called Expelled. And I don't know all the details, but as someone who works in the film industry, do you know about this movie, Expelled, that's coming out by Ben Stein?
Yeah, I do know about it, and I haven't seen it. But I what I've heard about it is that it's just a sort of, you know, fairly regular attack on evolution and a defense of intelligent design, where you find... where whatever is not understood about the evolutionary process is therefore taken to mean that the whole evolutionary process doesn't work, which in a way is the biblical approach to science, which is that if God is not perfect, then he's not worth having. If the whole Bible, you know, if bits of the Bible don't work, none of it works. And I think that's a foolish way of looking at the Bible and a foolish way of looking at science.
Can you tell me a little bit more about your project, Science Debate 2000? You alluded to it earlier.
Yes, Science Debate 2008, which you can go to our website, sciencedebate2008.com. And it was an idea that really, I suppose it had its roots in Kitzmiller v. Dover, where I saw how science could be made exciting and interesting to a wide audience. But it has nothing to do with that trial, or indeed evolution, on another level. When I started watching the presidential debates, and I've watched most of them, it was kind of, I was really genuinely surprised to see that none of the candidates were being asked questions about the environment, health and medicine, or science and technology policy, by which I mean there were no questions about climate change, there was no questions about the fragility of the oceans, there were no questions about the potential for a great deal of drought. There were no questions about species loss and what effect that may have on the environment. Then when you go to, which are obviously huge questions for not just Americans, but for the entire world, and, of course, questions that have economic implications as well as humanitarian ones, then you go to health and medicine. There were no questions really about stem cell research, the ethical implications of decoding the genome, and the opportunities in both of those. No questions about how we invest in medicine, bioethical questions, healthcare. And then when you come to science and technology policy, there were no questions about science education, no questions about the fact that science and technology have, it is thought, provided 50% of the economic health of America, and that a lot of that economic benefit from science and technology is moving to Asia. because we're not educating our children properly. We're not investing in new technology and new science. So all of those issues together go from the pure economic to the most pressing of humanitarian issues. And it seemed to me that those issues could be grouped together in a fantastic debate that would discuss all of these issues under the banner of science and technology, and perhaps function as a debate that would stimulate young people to become more interested in science and technology as they were in the 50s and 60s. And that such a debate should exist not just now, but in every presidential election in the future. I mean, to me, it's kind of amazing that this debate hasn't existed for the last 30 years, because everybody who knows anything about science and technology could see all of the issues that we're talking about coming 30 years ago. I mean, I know people who 30 years ago were talking about alternative energy sources and so on and so forth. It's kind of a fantastic thing that this hasn't been happening. And then we formed this organization, me and a few friends of mine, and the idea is that it will continue to press for this in this electoral cycle. And we now have the AAAS involved with us. We have which is the largest scientific organization on Earth, general science organization. We have the Union of Concerned Scientists. We have, I think, the Council on Competitiveness, which is a sort of business group that wants to make business ethically and environmentally responsible. And I think we're about to get another huge signatory that may make the debate actually happen. And we want to make the debate happen in this electoral presidential cycle. We want to make it happen in the next one. But we also want to inject the idea that science and technology are things that you have to talk about before you take office, because they're, whether it be gubernatorial, senatorial, congressional, that these are issues that must be discussed because they're so grave, so important, and so potentially beneficial both economically and from a humanitarian point of view. So we've formed this organization called Science Debate that will press for this, you know, forever, for the foreseeable future.
Well, I wish you good luck in that project. I'd like to ask you just two more questions to wrap this up. The Institute for Humanist Studies, which produces this podcast, has just taken over the International Darwin Day celebration. And this is an effort to celebrate Charles Darwin and the scientific method, science and humanity throughout the world. But I want to ask you a question, because it's related to your Science Debate 2008. A lot of people view Darwin Day as kind of an atheist holiday or a humanist celebration. Are you concerned that science gets, associated so closely with atheism? Do you think that's something we need to watch out for?
I do. I think it's a mistake. I think you can bring for example, in Science Debate 2008, we have an evangelical scientist, and a scientist who's an evangelist called Calvin DeWitt, who, you know, on 99% of what I think should happen in this debate, he thinks too. And I think there is a way to be inclusive from a scientific point of view, and that, you know, one can lose a great deal by being too shrill about this. I myself think of myself in a way as being a post-atheist, in the sense that if I look at the analogy I would make is that if I look at the British royal family and its position in English life, you have this kind of old lady with the hat and the handbag. You have the jug-eared son. You have Diana, who actually sort of did her job but was clearly unbalanced. You have the offspring who go to parties with swastikas on their arms, you know, a costume party, but nonetheless, you know, you see the kind of fallibility of the royal family. Nobody really believes that no one believes in the magic of royal blood. When you see the Queen come out on the balcony and wave to you, you kind of know she's waving goodbye. But nobody is incensed about the royal family. We kind of accept them. They're quaint. I actually think they should be gotten rid of, because I think they put a face on England that is kind of quaint and ridiculous and holds us back from being taken seriously. But you don't really, no one defines themselves, even those who are against the royal family in England, you don't define yourself as being an anti-royalist, because it's just sort of slipping off into a different kind of relevancy. And that's how I look at religion. I think it's time to just sort of start attacking the many serious problems we have, some of which are political and to do with the democratic process, which has replaced the royal system. And you just have to deal with them in a rational and humane way, and be forgiving.
Matthew Chapman, if you could ask your great-great-grandfather one question, what would that question be?
What were his motives for being so timid in a political sense? I mean, he left the job of sort of defending his theory to Huxley. And I always wondered if that was a really shrewd move on, you know, and this is where you talk about the division between science and politics, because really what Huxley was doing was taking on the philosophical and political implications of Darwin's idea and defending them. And was Darwin being incredibly smart in removing himself from that debate, or was it just a psychological inability he had to fight aggressively for things he believed in?
Well, Matthew Chapman, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, you're very welcome.
I had thought that by now my theory would be established, disproved, or obsolete. But I would never have expected organized religious resistance to persist so tenaciously. In 1925, the Tennessee legislature in America had passed a state law which forbade the teaching of evolution in the public schools. A courtroom drama took place in the little rural town of Dayton, Tennessee. There, a young man named John T. Scopes was arrested for teaching evolution to his high school biology students. On a sweltering July afternoon, Mr. Scopes waited for the jury to make its decision. Waiting on a jury down in Dayton, Tennessee. They about to lock me up and throw away the key. Uh-huh. Why, you would think that I'm some kind of crook. My only crime is teaching Mr. Darwin's book. That jury's got a little something to decide. Down here you best be careful of your speech. You can get yourself busted just for what you teach. Oh yeah. And if you think out loud, you'll likely find the school board gonna put you out on your behind. So you got a little something to decide.
Jess, what are we listening to?
Well, Duncan, I will tell you more about who we're listening to, but first, tell our listeners where they can learn more about Matthew Chapman.
Yes. If you'd like to, you can visit matthewchapman.us to learn more about Matthew's books and projects and films. And if you want to learn more about his science debate project, visit sciencedebate2008.com.
That song was A Little Something to Decide by Richard Milner from his musical, Charles Darwin, Live in Concert. And thanks to Richard, I was able to speak to someone very special by phone last Monday.
Hello.
Hi, this is Jess. Is this Charles Darwin?
Hello, yes it is.
Charles Darwin, it's quite an honor to speak to you. I have to say, I never thought that I'd be speaking with Charles Darwin on the telephone. And I guess you probably never thought you'd be speaking to someone else on this thing called the telephone either.
Well, in my day, we wrote letters. In fact, in the Darwin family, we had a saying, write a letter, write a letter. Writing it will make it better. And we wrote thousands of letters. The telephone was invented while I was still around, you know. It came in 1876. And many of the well-to-do in my neighborhood in Kent, in the English countryside, had telephones installed. It was the latest thing. But I absolutely refused. I would not have my privacy interrupted by somebody ringing any time they care to yank you out of your work and yank you out of your thoughts and just grab you onto that line. So I refused to have it, and I continued writing letters. You know, the upshot of that is, Jessica, that I left about 14,000 letters behind. And there's a whole industry. There's the Darwin Correspondence Project in Cambridge, England. They have scholars just studying and publishing 30 volumes of my letters, one of the most complete records of a Victorian and all his correspondence. So I'm, in a sense, I'm very glad I never went to the telephone. But I'm delighted to talk to you on this infernal machine.
Well, thank you so much. Now, February 12th is approaching, which is the day that you were born. Did you ever think that people all around the world would be celebrating your birthday?
Oh, you know, I'm sort of conflicted. I'm so sick of hearing about dear me, you know. I'm focused on my work. The fame never concerned me, and in fact, I hated public speaking. I never gave lectures. I used to send my dear friend Thomas Henry Huxley out to argue with the bishops and such and give public debates. Thomas Huxley, you know, was the founder of a great intellectual lineage. He was the grandfather of the novelist Aldous Huxley and the biologist Julian Huxley, and he was the teacher of H.G. Wells, and many of my ideas entered the mainstream through Huxley. He was the man who would go out and debate the bishops and carry on the political aspects of things. And there was a famous situation in Oxford in 1860, known as the Oxford Debate, where Huxley was challenged by Samuel Wilberforce, the Bishop of Oxford. And Huxley was somewhat unknown at the time, and Wilberforce was great and powerful, and he got up and he said, "Perhaps Professor Huxley can tell us whether he is descended from an ape on the side of his grandfather or his grandmother." And young Thomas Huxley got up and he said, "Ladies and gentlemen, my Lord Bishop, I did not come prepared to discuss such a question. I would not have occurred to me to raise such a matter. When we speak of descent in biology, we speak of terms of thousands, perhaps millions of years, not certainly not in terms of one's direct familial ancestry, but if the question is put to me, would I rather have for an ancestor a venerable grinning ape or a man of great gifts, a man of great intellect, a man of privilege, a man of great oratory, a man of position in the community who uses that position and those gifts and those powers and those talent for the mere purpose of making a mockery of those engaged in serious scientific inquiry, why then I unhesitatingly affirm my preference for the ape." I don't know. Fame didn't interest me, really. Perhaps on some level I had a bit of ego, but really the thing was the work. The thing was the work, to try to read the book of nature.
Actually, we were just speaking to your great-great-grandson, Matthew Chapman, and he had a question for you.
Oh, an excellent fellow, Matthew. Did you know that Matthew is a Hollywood screenwriter by profession?
You know, I did just learn that.
Yes, and he considers a Hollywood screenwriter the lowest form of life. And he has said that he has descended from myself into the lowest form of existence. Wonderful man.
Yes, he is. Now, Matthew was just curious why you left it to others to to speak about your work in the political arena? Why were you so timid about your controversial theories?
Well, there are several reasons. One is I was constitutionally very averse to public controversy. I became physically ill speaking in public. And also, I did not think that confrontation with religionists was the way to go. I had the belief, probably naive in my day, but I had the belief that if we just shone the light of reason and science on some of these questions, that these superstitions would eventually fade away, that what I considered the dark shadows of the human mind that had been enthralled since the medieval times with these various stories and superstitions and yes, belief in deity, you know, that I started out studying for the church, you know. I started out at Cambridge studying theology. I was going to be a country vicar. My father said I could collect beetles and save souls and collect souls at the same time. But gradually that belief left me. Eventually I did become what you would call an atheist. In my day, that was such a dirty word. You couldn't say it. You couldn't even... I called myself a materialist, a materialist naturalist, and people got the point. But I sought to show through what I hoped would be an exemplary life and raising my children and being a county magistrate and helping keep order in the neighborhood and conducting myself without scandal. I wanted to show that you didn't have to have a belief in a supernatural being to guarantee good behavior or that you were an upright person, that you could live a life, I guess today they would call it a humanist or a something of that sort, that you didn't need these props and crutches of the supernatural to be a good person and to live a good life.
Sure. So hearing that, it must disappoint you that 150 years later, after the publication of Your Origin of Species, Americans are still fussing over it.
Well, it's astounding, isn't it? I mean, I really thought that little by little these shadows would die away in the light of reason, but it hasn't proven the case. I was terribly naive. There are reasons why this sort of tenacity of religious belief and the rise of American fundamentalism, which, by the way, only took place in the early 20th century. Fundamentalist Christianity, for example, it was formulated in the 1920s. In the 19th century, there were many churches that embraced the idea of evolution as God's plan. The problem with that is that when a religion embraces a science, it's immediately in trouble. Because, you see, religion has to always be eternal and never change. And science is constantly changing by its very nature. So if religion attaches itself to some scientific beliefs, it rapidly becomes out of date.
So how do you feel about things like the lawsuits for bringing intelligent design into the classroom?
Well, what a bunch of foolishness it is. I mean, this is nothing new. The thing that astounds me is that everybody thinks it's new. This has been going on since before I published Origin of Species in 1859. This is constant debate. This so-called intelligent design is not a new thing at all. I mean, when I was a young man, I read a man called William Paley. He was a theologian who wrote books about what he called natural theology, proving God, the existence of God, through the study of nature. And that was the argument. If you found a watch in a field, there had to be a maker. There had to be a designer of that watch. You know, there was a very famous American preacher called Henry Ward Beecher at a church in Brooklyn. And he said he thought that God was grander and the evolution was grander in the wholesale than in the retail. What did he mean by that? He said, well, when I find a watch in a field, I don't just think of the watch designer. I think of the man that designed the factory. Somebody had to make a factory and tool it up and train the workers to make 100,000 watches a week. Isn't that much more impressive?
Absolutely. Now, there's this persistent rumor amongst some hopeful creationists that you renounced your theory of evolution and accepted Jesus on your deathbed. Is there any truth to that?
Oh, no. That's one of the rumors, you know. that the Christian fundamentalists and their precursors tacked on to it. There was this book by a fellow called Jim Moore who debunked that myth some years ago. My deathbed, I said that I never regretted living a life of science. My only regret was that I did not do more direct good for my fellow creatures. I think if I have any regrets, it's that I wasn't more of a philanthropist, and, you know, my father was a doctor, and my grandfather was a doctor, and in my youth I did some tending to the sick. And my only regret is that that I was so encased in my ivory tower of theories that that I didn't go out and do more direct good to people.
Well, Charles Darwin, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I understand, I know that you have thousands of fans around the world, but you have one in particular named Richard Milner, who actually travels around the world performing a musical that he created called Charles Darwin Live and in Concert. Just curious if you've gotten the chance to catch that show yet?
Oh, what an excellent show that is. I do recommend it to anyone who's interested in my theories and in the impact of my theories. And Mr. Milner, in his show, wrote a song where Thomas Huxley, when he first read The Origin of Species, was changed by it. His life was changed by my book. And his first reaction was, of course, how incredibly stupid not to have thought of that myself. And Mr. Milner thought there was a song cue, if ever he heard one.
Let's play that song now.
Of course! How incredibly stupid not to have thought of that myself! Of course! Of course! It must be so! I should have seen it long ago. Twas adaptive radiation that produced the mighty whale. His hands have grown to flippers, and he has a fishy tail. Selections made him streamline for his liquid habitat. Why didn't I think of that? There was an ancient mammal that could hop and leap around, but with webbing twixt his fingers, he could fly right off the ground. And so this mousy creature evolved into a bat. Why didn't I think of that? There are fossils in the ground, protozoa in the sea. All these unrelated facts made a monkey out of me. But now I see how species were selectively defined. Oh, how could I have been so ruddy blind? There was an ancient monkey with a long and curly tail. This ape evolved into a man. He's teaching now at Yale. A chimp could pass for upper class in gloves and a cravat. Why didn't I think of that? The struggle for survival lies outside the jungle, too. Just take a look at Parliament. It's better than a zoo. We're at each other's throats, just like the bulldog and the cat. But why didn't I? Your ideas on evolution will create a revolution. Why didn't I think of that?
That was Why Didn't I Think of That from Charles Darwin Live and in Concert. Now, Mr. Darwin, can you pass the phone to Richard Milner? I hear that he's there with you.
Yes, I will be happy to do that. Oh, Richard! Richard! Hello, Richard Milner here.
Hello, Richard Milner. Thank you for speaking with us. We're talking about your show, Charles Darwin, Live and in Concert.
Oh, yes. It's Charles Darwin's favorite show. And it was Stephen Jay Gould's favorite show, too.
Well, that is pretty impressive, I must say. Just curious, why did you decide to do a musical based on Charles Darwin's life?
I've always loved musicals, and I was giving lectures about Darwin, and I just thought I might throw in a few songs, and the audience liked it, and so I made more songs, and the lecture got smaller, and the songs got bigger, and the show evolved, and it became Charles Darwin Live and in Concert. It sort of was an organic thing. I didn't set out to do it.
Let's hear one of those songs from your show.
So this is a Gilbert and Sullivan parody, and like all my songs, it talks about something based on a real historical event, just as Why Didn't I Think of That is based on something Huxley actually said and wrote. Darwin actually had nightmares about being hanged for blasphemy. And so here's Darwin's nightmare.
I was lying awake with a dismal headache, and my sleep was put off by anxiety. But I feared that my plan of explaining how man had evolved would bring our notoriety. Though I fled London town for the village of Down and a home that is quiet and regal, yet I get no repose and I can't even doze without dreaming I'm back on the Beagle. We're rounding the horn in a furious storm, and our progress is measured in inches. Then we're rolling around till the crew's almost drowned, and they scatter like terrified finches. Fitzroy's in a mood, and he's coming unglued and cannot say where our next port is. I fear he's unwell, for he sprouted a shell and turns into a monstrous tortoise. He ignores the enormity of this deformity, carapace, scales, and the rest of it, and vows his complexion is close to perfection, and as for my fears, makes a jest of it. After 10,000 miles, the Galapagos Isles, now I'm tense and exceedingly weary, but I know that this place could result in disgrace when I use it to further my theory. Then I scramble ashore as a sea lion's roar, and I hear a contemptuous snicker. I glance up in a tree, and there, what do I see? 7 chimps and an Anglican vicar. It's not hard to tell, they're all mad as hell, and I ask, what's the source of your fury? His grace's retort is silence in court, for I am your judge and your jury. With a barrister's smile, he declares I'm on trial and tells me the cause for his action. You cannot escape, for you said man's an ape, and my clients demand satisfaction. To challenge my fitness, he calls his first witness, an albatross down from Guyana. But the bird flicks his tail and turns into a snail, then uncoils and becomes an iguana. The judge is perplexed, and I say, don't be vexed, we've been changing since Adam's arrival. The monk in his cloister descends from an oyster, the fittest have mastered survival. His honor says, quiet, the court will not buy it, you mock, sir, the truth of creation. You played fast and loose, now your neck's in a noose, and you're off to eternal damnation. I've given up hope as he tightens the rope, and the chimps start to make a commotion. When a wave hits the shore with a volcanic roar, and the island sinks under the ocean. With a shriek I awake, and it's all a mistake, the iguana's really a kitten. No chimps are in sight on this miserable night, and no wonder I'm back in Great Britain. Regular wreck with a crick in my neck. My anxiety's hardly diminished. But the darkness has passed, and it's daylight at last, and the night's been too long. Ditto, ditto, my song. And thank goodness they're both of them finished.
That was Darwin's Nightmare from Charles Darwin, live and in concert by Richard Milner. Richard, can you tell us about some of the different venues that you performed at?
Oh, I've been fortunate to perform all over the world. I've done it in Germany. I've done it in Australia, in Canberra, all over the U.S., including places that are creationist strongholds like Kansas. I did it in Lawrence, Kansas during the school textbook controversy. And I've done it... On the Galapagos. I did it on a cruise ship on the Galapagos Islands this year, which was really a thrill, and I did it on one of the islands on land.
So when you did it in Kansas, how did they like it there?
I was invited by Kansas Citizens for Science, who wanted me to. They were having a program to counter the local school board, and they won the election, threw the rascals out, the creationists that were trying to inject religion into the schools.
Do you ever face any opposition from any audience members?
Well, occasionally. I don't like to debate. I leave that to other people who are very good at it. I try to turn the whole thing into art, into music, into an experience, and people bring to it what they like. Occasionally, I remember in New Orleans, I had... some kids wearing creationist T-shirts and so on, and they told me that I asked them why they came if they were so opposed. They said, "Well, the biology teacher said they could get extra credit if they proved they came." So one of the creationist girls asked me to sign her program so she could prove to her teacher that she was there. And another girl came up to me and said, "Thank you so much for bringing this tradition here. They call me a pagan and an atheist. My friends just treat me like, you know, like an antichrist. And she said, it's just so wonderful to have you bring this tradition here in such a, the scientific tradition, in such an entertaining way.
For our listeners, could you just tell them, you know, if someone was going to see your show, what could they expect as an audience member?
Well, I will come out as Darwin, and I will talk about my life and my work, and there's about 300 slides, and there's 11 original songs, and then Darwin changes to Huxley and to his friendly rival, Alfred Russel Wallace, and then we go into the Scopes trial after Darwin's death. We have a blues for Mr. Scopes. We have the German Ernst Haeckel, who talks about, you know, establishing Darwinism as the basis for what became Nazism. Darwinism has been used by many people in many ways, not all of them good. And one of the points of the show is how this idea has leapt the bounds of science and percolated into politics and religion and law. And so you get a complete multimedia experience.
So you mentioned that the next 2 years are going to be, do you have any plans for the big 200-year, the bicentennial bash for Darwin Day?
Well, I expect to be performing all through that year, and I'm accepting reservations for bookings of the show.
And how do people book you, Richard?
Well, one could contact me via my site, www.darwinlive.com, or write me at richard@darwinlive.com. I'm also bringing out a book I've been working on for 10 or 15 years called Darwin's Universe. It'll be published by the University of California Press during the bicentennial year, and it's a huge compendium, not only of Darwin's life and work, but of all the repercussions in art, literature, pop culture, and so on. It has 500 pictures, and it's been something I've been working on a long time, my magnum opus.
It sounds great. Well, Richard Milner and Charles Darwin, thank you both for taking the time to speak with us today.
Well, it's my pleasure. On behalf of myself and Mr. Darwin, it's been a delight speaking with you, Jessica, and a pleasure being with your listeners.
Once again, that website is darwinlive.com for those interested in booking Richard Milner in this wonderful performance. We have some great listener comments, but we're out of time this week.
But if you'd like to leave us a listener comment, you can do so by calling our toll-free number, 877-659-1515.
Don't forget to visit darwinday.org, and also check out our weekly e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org.
You can download transcripts and previous podcast episodes at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
The use of our theme song was generously donated by Holly Near. You can learn more at hollynear.com.
And we're going to take this show out with a song called Charles Robert Darwin by The Artichoke Band. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. Thanks for listening.
Happy Darwin Day.
Bitten by an insect, never did he suspect. He suffered all his life from Chagas disease.